Today, momentum wins as records keep falling. The Property Imperative Weekly to the 18th of January 2020. Hello again, I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to the latest post covering finance and prop news with a distinctively Australian flavour. In this week's roundup, we look at why markets keep going higher, the latest data from China, the rise of ESG investing against a backcloth of rising risks, according to the World Economic Forum, and locally, here, markets are aping the US despite more retail closures and continuing signs of economic weakness. It's more about momentum than fundamentals. And we'll start with the global scene, but if you want to jump direct to the Australian segment, the time code is shown below. On Friday, Wall Street climbed to record highs, with major indices turning to their strongest weekly gains since August, after strong US housing data and signs of resilience in the Chinese economy raised hopes of a rebound in global growth. The United States and China sealed a Phase 1 trade deal, pausing an 18-month tariff dispute that has weighed on financial markets globally. The Phase 1 deal has avoided a further escalation in tariffs between the two sides and led to a partial rollback of some existing trade taxes. But really, it's small beer, and many of the deep issues remain, as do many of the existing tariffs. And there could be a fallout as China agrees to take more US goods, redirecting imports from other markets, including Australia. However, many investors expect companies to be more upbeat about the future following this truce in the trade war, and the US Senate also endorsed a new trade deal between the US, Mexico and Canada on Thursday. US home building surged to a 13-year high in December, up 17% to an annualized pace of 1.61 million, suggesting the housing market recovery was back on track amid low mortgage rates. This, coupled with stronger than expected retail sales earlier this week for December, which came in better than expected at 0.5% compared to estimates of 0.4%, underpinned investor confidence in the US economy and boosted sentiment. The US GDP growth is expected to slow, falling from 2.4% in 2019 to 2.1% in 2020, according to the IMF, or even below 2%, according to other forecasters. However, with eased trade disputes and global growth possibly bottoming out, the US economic number could surprise on the upside. Earning estimates for the fourth quarter have already weakened slightly in the last week, as initial reports from big banks and a smattering of other companies filtered in. Still, in the market overall, the multiples have expanded, and that's really the risk of the market. But about 7% of S&P 500 companies have reported quarter four results so far, with 74% posting better than expected earnings per share. All three major indices closed at record highs. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 0.17% to end at 29,348.1, while the S&P 500 gained 0.39% to 3,329.62, and up 3% so far this year. The S&P 500 is trading at around 18 times expected earnings, similar to levels it briefly hit 2 years ago. The Nasdaq Composite added 0.34% to 9,388.94. And for the week, the S&P 500 added 1.96%, the Dow Jones rose 1.82%, and the Nasdaq increased 2.29%. Google's parent Alphabet rose 2%, extending gains after it became the fourth US company to top a market value of $1 trillion on Thursday, and they closed at 1,479.52. Apple, among other techs, continued to perform well, rising 1.11% to 318.73 as Nomura and Morgan Stanley became the latest on Wall Street to upgrade their price targets on the iPhone maker. The five most valuable US tech companies now account for over 17% of the S&P 500, up from 11% back in 2015. Even in the face of heightened regulatory pressure, the dominant companies continued to grow and attract investment dollars. It's hard to say one stock in particular set the tone, but Morgan Stanley might have done just that on Thursday. It's not often that you see one of the big institutional banks go up nearly 7% and then just hang out there all day, but that's the way things went. The company enjoyed a surge in quarter four fixed income trading, and analysts just hadn't predicted that kind of performance. Generally, bank earnings looked very impressive, with the exception of Wells Fargo and a bottom line miss from Goldman Sachs, which closed at 249.46. When you look at these two, however, the issues were isolated to those particular companies and didn't reflect the broader industry trends. Because the banks, by the very nature of their business, reflect so much economic and market sentiment, when a bank executive like JP Morgan Chase CEO Jamie Dimon says in the company's quarter four earnings release that the US consumer continues to be in a strong position and the robust holiday season led to a 10% jump in credit card transactions for JPM during the quarter, he's talking from a position of authority. The S&P 500 financials closed at 509.47, having touched new highs once again. On the other hand, Boeing fell again as one analyst warned that the airplane maker's fourth quarter profit will be hit significantly by a substantial charge due to the grounding of the 737 MAX jets. We are surprised the stock has held up as well as it has, he said, considering the company is perhaps facing the most severe crisis in its 100-year history, but we continue to see the financial risks not fully reflected in the stock. Boeing's efforts to restore its reputation have suffered several setbacks. The latest arrived on Friday, as the company said it was addressing a new software issue with the 737 MAX, discovered during testing last week. Boeing fell 2.36% to trade at 324.15 at the close. The volatility index was down 1.79% to 1210, a new one-month low, so fear is off. And investors brushed off softer US inflation data in favour of stronger retail sales, manufacturing activity, and the pickup in housing starts. However, stabilisation in US yields and the record-breaking moves in US stocks are the primary reasons why investors are piling into US dollars. The 10-year bond closed at 1.825, while the 3-month stood at 1.561, so no inversion here. The euro-US dollar was down 0.4% to 1.1091, and the US dollar index futures was up 0.34% at 97.393. A pair of US inflation reports this week were on the low side of expectations, but there is a clear trend higher in core measures and wages growth to a lesser extent. The Federal Reserve cut rates by a quarter percentage point for 3 months back to back in 2019, before bringing that easing cycle to a halt in December. With US economic data now mostly upbeat, analysts don't expect the central bank to embark on a new round of cuts unless the trade war recurs. Some observers still insist that the Fed's T-bill purchases and rep operations are equivalent to quantitative easing, though the officials deny this vehemently. The rally in US stocks to new record highs is cited as evidence, even though stocks rallied strongly before the Fed announced the T-bill purchases and sustained rep operations. From the lows of December 2018 through to August 2019, the S&P 500 gained almost 30% and has risen another 11.5% since the end of September 2019. The Fed indicated that it will reduce the amount offered in the term repos starting next month to $30 billion from $35 billion. And probably after the mid-April tax date, the Fed will likely reduce its new T-bill purchases, $60 billion a month, sometime in the second quarter, and maintain rolling over maturing issues to maintain the size of its balance sheet. It is not just a case of should it be seen as a tightening or tapering, but will it in fact be seen as such by the investment community? The US Treasury announced also that it will soon begin issuing 20-year bonds. The Trump administration has been pushing to issue longer-dated securities to take advantage of the low interest rates. However, there was a pushback against the 50-year and 100-year bonds that the administration appeared to favour. Gold futures for February delivery was up 0.44% to 1,557.35, and crude oil rose 0.44% to 58.78 a barrel, and Bitcoin was up 1.92% to 8,884.2. Consumer spending in the UK contracted for the second month in a row in what is normally the most critical shopping season. And Johnson's smooth election victory failed to bolster demand. Instead of rising by 0.6% as the median forecast in the Bloomberg survey anticipated, retail sales fell by 0.6%. And adding insult to injury, the November series was revised to show a 0.8% decline rather than 0.6%. Excluding petrol, retail sales dropped by 0.8%, matching the November decline. Neither the election results nor Black Friday and Cyber Monday sales appeared to lift the UK consumer spirits. The retail sales deflator fell by 0.6%, suggesting lower prices may have exaggerated the decline. Still, retail sales have been flat or falling for the last 5 months of 2019. Given the recent spate of comments from officials, the market has moved to discount a 75% chance of a rate cut when the Bank of England meets on January the 30th. A week ago, the odds were less than 25%. At minimum, when they meet again, more than two members of the Monetary Policy Committee could vote in favour of easing. Interestingly, sterling is just beginning to lose momentum. The FTSE closed at 7,642.56, up 0.85%, while the pound US dollar stood at 1.3010, down 0.5%, continuing the weakening trend of recent days. The pound, though, is doing a mighty excellent job of ignoring the considerable move lower in UK rates as traders see the light of day, meaning that if the Bank of England does cut, it will be a one and done insurance move before Mark Carney moves on. In Europe, the ECB is currently undergoing policy review and could change their inflation goals for the first time in 17 years. This change in its explanation could have a dramatic impact on the euro ahead. But meantime, in Germany, the 10-year Bund has risen to minus 0.219% over recent days. And interestingly, thanks to a Supreme Court decision there, Germany just got a universal basic income via the back door. Beneficiaries deemed fit to work had to present evidence of their efforts to end their financial dependency, even though job centre agents had considerable discretion as to what to count towards that. The refusal to show any effort whatsoever usually resulted in cancellation of benefits. But this has now been declared unconstitutional by the German Supreme Court. The verdict means even if the beneficiary fails to apply for jobs, they will, under all circumstances, retain 70% of the food allowance plus housing allowance plus health insurance for life. And that's more than €1,000 each month. The German government has also struck a deal with the country's coal-producing regions to phase out the use of coal power by 2038 in return for compensation and benefits worth €40 billion. Berlin will also set aside €4.35 billion for utilities such as RWE, which will close some of their coal plants early. The deal removes one of the last obstacles to a historic energy transition in Europe's largest economy. Angela Merkel's coalition government pledged last year to switch off all coal-fired power stations, but has since battled to secure political support from federal states such as North Rhine-Westphalia, Brandenburg and Saxony, where Germany's mines and power plants are concentrated. The deal presented by senior ministers on Thursday means Germany will end the use of nuclear and coal power at the same time, sharply increasing the country's dependence on renewable resources of power such as wind and solar. This again underscores the revolution underway, as exemplified by BlackRock's announcement that they will divest investments in thermal coal by mid-2020 and focus on ethical investing in response to climate change. We discuss this in detail in our post, Is BlackRock an ESG canary? The tide is turning, with $30 trillion of investment, two-thirds of all investments, now being made on an ESG, environmental, social, governance basis. This shows us that the market will push companies and countries to change their stance as more entities seek to become carbon neutral. This is a big deal. As the World Economic Forum put it, the world cannot wait for the fog of geopolitical and geoeconomic uncertainty to lift, opting to ride out the current period in the hope that the global system will snap back, runs the risk of missing crucial windows to address pressing challenges. And central banks haven't been able to spark broad-based inflation, but they've been remarkably successful at creating asset inflation. With all the rate cuts last year, an underrated risk is a surprise rise in housing prices globally. We're already starting to see signs of tighter markets, for example, in New Zealand, which just posted a 12% rise in house prices according to the December data released by the REINZ. Prices and sales volumes varied across the regions, but even in Auckland, there was an average annual rise of 3.5%, with an average price of $890,000. So the Reserve Bank New Zealand's rate cuts and lending loosening is coming through. However, New Zealand's manufacturing sales measures contracted in December, down 0.3%. So the reliance of positive housing growth, despite high debt, and an emphasis on sales to first-time buyers continues. New Zealand inflation numbers are scheduled to be released next week. And the latest data from China showed growth, as reported, slowing at 6.1% over the last year, its weakest in nearly 30 years, and real growth is probably lower still, as consumers there are cautious amid high debt and central bank intervention. However, industrial production rose at 6.9% compared with 5.9% as forecast, while retail sales similarly outperformed. They jumped by 8% compared with 7.8% expected. Capacity utilization also moved higher to 77.5%, so officials strongly hinted that another rate cut isn't coming, but they are expected to cut the loan prime rate soon and may take additional stimulus measures on the fiscal side. Overall, the data suggests that Chinese economic growth has started to stabilize and near-term momentum is picking up. We'll see. The Shanghai Composite closed at 3,075.50, slightly higher. And the US dollar yuan fell a little to 6.8789. Hi, it's Liz Interruption, but if you're getting value from this post and have not done so, please consider subscribing to this channel or ring the bell for custom alerts. Plus, please consider supporting our efforts. You can make a one-off donation via PayPal, here's the link, or subscribe via Patreon for as little as $3 US a month or more to get access to exclusive additional content. Alternatively, you can also donate using Bitcoin. Here is the QR code. The links are in the comments below. I really appreciate your support, which enables us to continue to make more great content. Thanks very much. Now, back to the current show. And so, to the local market. We had a flow of economic data this week, with lending flows growing, but more slowly. See our post, new housing loans are up, but just how much? In trend terms, flows of new loans for own occupiers, investors, and refinance all show slowing growth rates, along with first-time buyers, where the average loan is now an astonishingly high $408,000. And you can see our post, First-Time Buyer Deposit Scheme, Fish or Fowl, for more on this. And our household financial confidence ratings and our surveys of those seeking to purchase both ease lower, although future expectations of home price movements are still growing, led by portfolio investors. The latest from CoreLogic shows that prices are still rising in most centres, but they remain below their previous peaks in the major markets, and the rate of change of growth continues to slow. Now the holidays are over, we expect to see more listed property coming onto the market, but lending will remain tight, despite the recent loosening of standards. According to a survey by comparison platform Finder, rising property prices, particularly the return to price growth seen in Sydney and Melbourne after their market slumps, have raised fresh worries about how aspiring homeowners can afford to get onto the property ladder. So the bank of mum and dad is back and is helping adult children with not only housing costs, but everything from fuel and phone bills to holidays. More than half of Australian parents surveyed subsidise the lifestyles of their adult children, with almost 40% letting them live rent-free and about the same proportion paying for their groceries. About one in three parents help pay for mobile phones, internet or pay other bills, while one in five for some or all of their children's holidays. Another 15% lent or gifted money for a home deposit. 15% charged lower rents, 5% went guarantor on a home loan, and 4% helped with mortgage payments. The economic impact of the bushfires is hard to assess. As we reported, one estimate puts the gross costs above $100 billion. Our own estimate is around $30 billion over 3 years, with a reduction in tourism and agricultural exports on the cards. It's only a matter of time before data reflects the negative damage caused by the fires. One thing to consider is the impact on insurers and the need to repatriate Aussie dollar flows. Large local insurers such as IAG, QBE and Suncorp all have extensive reinsurance protection, with European reinsurers exposed via quota shares and aggregate cover. From their reports, UBS expects rough Australia reinsurance market shares of around 10% for Swiss Re, 6.8% for Munich Re, 3% for Hannover Re, and 1% for SCOR. So the presumption is that going forward, further claims will fall under the guise of European insured as the reinsurance limits have kicked in from the primary insurance. So from the European side of the equation, may need to buy Aussie to fund the insurance payouts. So this represents real demand for the Aussie ahead. And both UBS and Morgan Stanley indicated an expectation of the RBA cutting the cash rate again, saying that more economic support is required, and also questioning the size and timing of direct government spending. We'll see. And so to the markets. The ASX 100 closed at 5,858.10, up 0.32% to a new high, mirroring Wall Street. The ASX Financials Index was down a little to 6,231, still 1,000 points below its highs back in 2015. But banks moved a little higher and lower, with CBA down and Westpac and NAB up. The Aussie-US dollar was down to 68.74 as the US dollar strengthened. The Euro-Aussie cross was flat at 1.6136, while the Aussie gold cross rose 0.65% to 2,265.74. And the Aussie Bitcoin cross was up 3.65% to 12,991.40. Finally, a quick reminder that our next live stream Q&A event will run on Tuesday the 21st of January at 8 p.m. Sydney. The link is in the comments below. We'll be updating our scenarios and answering questions either live via the chat or taking questions beforehand from the DFA blog. Again, the links are in the comments below. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.